ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
4, 3, 2, 1.
G'day, Dr. Carl.
And lift off.
40 years on, we want to unpack the behind-the-scenes story of the Challenger disaster.
Obviously a major malfunction.
I saw it explode. I couldn't believe it.
Hear the whole story on our podcast, The Challenger Legacy, a new series of science fiction. Search for Science Fiction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
A heads up before we begin, this episode contains extended discussions about suicide and grief. Take care while listening.
I'm not glad it happened, but I know it happened for me to become a better person and for me to have the choice to go, all right, I'm going to do something with this horrible story. The worst thing that's ever happened to me is going to help make the world a better place too, just like my dad did.
Growing up in Cronulla, in Sydney's southern suburbs, the ocean has always played a central role in Blake Johnston's life. It's the site of his first memory. It's the source of his livelihood as a surf coach. It's the place most connected to his dad.
My very first memory is like just standing on the beach at the alley there at North Cronulla and having floaties on and being nervously excited to hit the water, and then having my dad next to me, you know, with the board under his arm, smiling, and then going out and riding waves on the shore with me up the front.
Professionally, Blake's father was a bricklayer and a builder, but surfing is what he loved to do.
My dad was a second generation Cronulla local. He was very stoic, he was calm, and he didn't tell us big stories about his glory surfing days and that. He just did his thing, did his best. We had 5 boys in our family, and life revolved around the beach.
5 boys is incredible. Where were you in the birth order?
I was dead bang in the middle. I was a middle child.
Middle child, right.
Yeah. I know now, just looking back, how hard it must have been for my parents. You know, 5 boys on a bricklayer's wage, trying to get ahead and everything. I have so much empathy and respect for you know, how challenging times must have been for them.
Were feelings or mental health discussed much in your family?
Nah, definitely not. Definitely not. There was not conversations around how we felt. We had a mum who was a bit more like me, and wearing the heart on the sleeve, emotional, and cared so much for us. But Dad was stoic, you know. Like I said, he was quiet and humble, and there was never any conversations about how he felt or, you know, what he was going through, and I can only just imagine it.
This stoicism and silence, it wasn't something Blake gave much thought to growing up, but it is something he thinks about now, because when Blake was 30, about 13 years ago now, he lost his father to suicide.
He was always my hero. He was my best mate, my hero, and I think that might have masked me looking for anything. I just saw the best in him, you know. Like, he was this hardworking, gentle giant that taught me surfing, that I wanted to make stoked and proud of me, and we had a beautiful relationship. So I have struggled with the guilt of going, why didn't I see these things? You know, I knew he was crazy tired from his work schedule, 60-year-old man still working 6 days a week and had sleep apnea, and would have struggled with a lot of things that come with that, you know, self-worth of not owning his own home. I look back and just think there would have been a lot on his plate.
For a good 5 years after his father's death, Blake says he wasn't himself. And that's not uncommon after the loss of someone so close to you by suicide, because suicide bereavement is complicated. As in Blake's case, there can be a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of second-guessing your own actions. Not to mention the shame and stigma that can come with having to explain this kind of loss to other people.
There is still this connotation about people dying by suicide. There must have been something wrong with that person, something wrong in the family, otherwise it wouldn't have happened.
The aftershocks of a loss to suicide are significant.
And the really scary thing is, losing someone close to you by suicide can elevate your own risk of suicide. That's especially the case for children who lose a parent in this way.
I went through the depth of every single emotion. I just didn't want to be another one in the 9 of Australians that take their own life. I didn't want to be another statistic. I wanted to be someone that made the world a better place.
So today, we're talking about the long-tail impacts of suicide. Why, despite millions of dollars spent on prevention over the years, numbers haven't gone down? And what it takes to find purpose after profound loss. I'm Sana Qadar from ABC Radio National. This is All in the Mind. At 30 years old, life was going pretty well for Blake. A former pro surfer, he'd overcome some bumpy years after his career ended, and he'd found his way again running a surf academy in Cronulla, where he grew up.
We just had our first baby boy, Bobby Wayne. The business was growing. We started doing retreats overseas, down the south coast, taking people beyond just Cronulla for their surfing lessons. And yeah, it was a really good time of our lives.
One day, as he was driving some students back from one of these retreats on the south coast, his sister-in-law rang him.
Reception was terrible, but she said, "I'm so sorry," and she seemed a bit frantic. And then a couple of moments later, she called back and said, "I'm so sorry, Blake, your dad's not with us anymore." And that was when I learned that Dad had taken his own life. I didn't know exactly how or what. It was just a complete descendants into numbness. There was still an hour of a car trip to get back to Mum and Dad's.
Wow.
And that hour felt like eternity. It was a complete dreamlike state that was total depth of uncertainty and just not knowing what to expect when we got back to Mum and Dad's.
At the home, he remembers police and flashing lights, his mother distraught, and his brothers consoling each other.
And I walked through the house. It was quieter than ever, normally filled with grandkids or one of me or my brothers dropping in, and walked to the back of the garage. And then by the time I'd got there, he was laying on the gurney. And I approached the gurney and he just looked so still and calm. It was a really weird feeling because it was like I was so sad, so confused, but he just looked at peace. He looked like he'd finally get the rest he deserved. I put my arm around him and gave him a kiss. He was so still and I just didn't want to let him go.
You talked about the shock of that day. I'm curious about like the emotional journey a person goes on in the like day or week afterwards. Like how long does that initial just shock and terror last before you get to the kind of the guilt, the shame, the other things you talked about? Or does it all just kind of hit like a kaleidoscope at once?
It is a profound sense of confusion. Deep in survival mode, the body feels tingly and numb. It's actually a sensation through the whole body. It's not just a thought in your head. It's you're deep into survival mode and it's hard to articulate anything for the first few days. It doesn't feel real. It's a dreamlike state that you don't know whether you've dreamt these moments or they're real. You could feel pretty disorientated through that process.
In Australia, there are more than 3,000 suicides a year, and the numbers are not going down.
This is Carl Andreessen, a researcher at the University of Melbourne's Centre for Mental Health and Community Wellbeing. He started his career 35 years ago as a social worker, working on suicide prevention. But he soon realised that there was a population that was being overlooked, people who were bereaved by suicide.
There was no support, there was no clinical services, no research activity.
So he pivoted to researching suicide bereavement. Do you have any thoughts on why the numbers haven't gone down? There has been so much attention and money put towards suicide prevention in the last couple of decades, but the numbers aren't budging. Do you have any thoughts on why it's not budging?
It's a very difficult question. We know that some strategies in suicide prevention are effective. For example, limiting the access to means for suicide, like securing, for example, hotspots at railways. Or controlling access to medication, for example. But apparently these well-examined methods of preventing suicide are not sufficient in itself to reduce the total number of suicides. One of the difficulties probably is that people who are suicidal are very often reluctant to disclose their suicidal feelings or suicidal thoughts. And for many reasons, but this also limits the possibility to intervene in a timely way. Right. And one of the most important risk factors for dying by suicide is having an attempted suicide in the past. But unfortunately, the attempted suicide, for example, could have occurred 10, 15 years ago. But then the risk for dying by suicide will continue over the lifetime.
Wow.
So then it's also difficult for clinicians to know or to estimate the suicide risk on long term for particular individuals, because in the end, the reasons why people die by suicide or what pushes them over the edge are also very individual. And the struggle, I think, for suicide prevention is that we know a lot about the risk factors that are at population level.
Right.
To identify this at an individual level is very difficult.
Yeah. That's incredible that that elevated risk remains for years afterwards. In terms of individual risk factors for his father, Blake didn't have a sense that his dad was struggling so deeply. Looking back now, he sees signs, but at the time, his suicide came as a complete shock.
Like, we went on my 30th, just before he passed, we went to a holiday at Byron Bay to celebrate, and all the family came up, and he had us sleep on the daybed outside, and he woke up and he felt guilty about having a day sleep on a holiday. It's the first holiday he'd ever had. And he's a 60-year-old man who works 6 days a week, and he felt guilty about a little day nap. I really wish that he could have just known how much we all just wanted him to relax. And, you know, he was held at such high regard. I'm just to see someone who was loved so much couldn't see the value in himself. And it's horrible, and no one should ever feel like that.
I'm so sorry that happened to you and your family.
Yeah, I'm sorry it happened to him.
Yeah.
Like, he had to go through that pain. And a message is, a really strong message that I got over the time of dealing with the grief, is that when people are struggling, that incredibly deep, dark, painful darkness they feel doesn't go away. It really just gets passed on to the people who love them.
That is exactly what happened with Blake. In the years after his father's death, he struggled immensely.
Yeah, look, I wasn't quite myself for a good half a decade after my dad took his own life.
He cycled through a range of emotions. Anger.
That he wasn't around anymore for me or my two young boys.
Guilt.
A question I always ask myself is, like, why does it hurt so much with the guilt, the bereavement of suicide? I think it's just the uncertainties, like, of what you could have done, how you didn't know, what didn't you see? And I think that's where the pain lies, because you really don't know. You don't have all the answers to it, and that you never will.
The kind of rumination that Blake describes, the questioning of what you could have done differently, what you didn't see, that is incredibly common after a loss by suicide. And it's one of the reasons researcher Carl Andreessen says people often report anxiety or depression or problems sleeping, problems with concentration, problems eating.
There's a whole range of mental health and somatic complaints that people may develop after the loss by suicide.
And one especially worrying aspect of all of this that possibly doesn't get discussed as much as it should is that research shows there is an elevated risk of suicide in the people who are left behind, grieving another person's suicide. The rumination spirals can contribute to this, but there are other reasons as well.
It certainly is a very important part that people struggle with these feelings for a very long time. Also, that what we often see is that people grieve by suicide, that there is a sort of discrepancy between the need for social support and what they receive from their environment, because other family members, friends, colleagues often do not know how to respond to someone who is bereaved by suicide. It feels awkward. So the bereaved people are very often left alone with their grief. And in case when it happens in a family, when you are a parent, for example, you also have the responsibility for taking care of your children or other family members. So it's also a bit of a struggle trying to find time and energy to look after yourself, and which can go on for several years. People can get exhausted, and people may also start thinking, I would be better off dead as well.
Mm.
And also you have the example. You know, if your partner or your father or mother or your child died by suicide, it also presents a little bit of an example of how you cope with problems, not necessarily in a conscious way, like I have to do the same thing as my partner did or my father did.
Right.
But it kind of works unconsciously as an example, as a possibility that you have.
Research from the Johns Hopkins Children's Center has also found that children who are under 18 when a parent dies by suicide are three times as likely to later die by suicide themselves.
What we see in the research and in the literature is that impact of a suicide loss usually has lifelong consequences for coping with difficulties, for relationships. It can affect functioning at school, for example, functioning with friends. And of course, most of the children in the end will end up well. People learn to cope with it, learn to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly for children and certainly during the first years, it is really a very critical experience.
One thing I'm wondering, given what you just said about lifelong impacts, is the advice to not tell young children the truth of how that parent died? Or like, how do you communicate what happened with a child?
Probably not telling the child is not the best option, because usually they find out.
Mm.
Very often children learn a lot by listening to what parents or others are telling amongst each other without noticing that the children are also listening.
Right.
So the general advice is that it's best to tell the children about what happened, of course, in a way that is understandable to them and that it not necessarily traumatizes them.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, it's important that they know, so that they can also learn to live with it and grieve in their own way.
And I suppose get the support they need.
Yes, of course.
You're listening to All in the Mind from ABC Radio National. I'm Sana Qadar. In a moment, we're going to talk about why suicide often splinters families, permanently altering relationships, and also what it takes to experience post-traumatic growth, and why not everyone seems to experience it. But first, you can't really talk about suicide in Australia without mentioning Indigenous families and communities. Because here are two very sobering statistics. The suicide rate among Indigenous adults is more than double the rate for non-Indigenous adults. And suicide is the leading cause of death among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children.
Suicide is something that has touched most Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families now. And in fact, what we're seeing now is families that have been impacted several times over.
This is Tanya Hervinen, a clinical psychologist.
I'm Jaron Bunabar, so my mum are from the East Kimberley.
And she's the CEO of Thirrily,
which is a Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander National Postvention Service.
Postvention is a bit of a strange word. It refers to the support that's offered to people who are grieving after a suicide. It's considered an important form of prevention, given that elevated risk we spoke about earlier and the people who are left behind grieving. Tanya actually tried to stay away in her career from working in this space.
Because we've had impacts within our own family, but it felt like it constantly presented itself in a lot of the areas of work. And it's not for the faint-hearted, but the most of the people that work in this space are because we've had the impacts ourselves and we do want things to be different.
She says while in general support can be lacking for people who are grieving after a suicide, that is especially pronounced for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, because many of the services that are available aren't always culturally safe, or they don't address collective grief.
When I first started to learn about the impacts of suicide many, many years ago, I read somewhere that one suicide can affect up to 8 people. What we're seeing now and what some of the research and what we're hearing from community is when we have had one loss, it can actually impact up to more than a couple of 100 people, and sometimes even the entire nation, because we're a collective society.
And so part of Theralee's role is to address that collective grief. They'll go into communities after a suicide and help in whatever way is required. Sometimes that might mean facilitating community discussions.
When we're having yarns about sensitive topics or topics that are still hurting our hearts, making sure that we have the right people in the room. Maybe this is the yarn for the elders, maybe this is the yarn for with young people, and making sure that there are the support mechanisms in place to support the yarns.
This work is vital because the suicide rate among First Nations people has only been trending upwards. The reasons why are complex and varied, having to do with the ongoing impact of colonization, intergenerational trauma, systemic inequality, including the fact that support services in rural and remote communities are limited at best, non-existent at worst.
There needs to be multi-layered mechanisms to support communities. It can't just be health professionals. It cannot just be clinical services. There has to be other ways for communities to heal and future-proof our next generation and the next generation after that.
If we come back to Blake's story now, it's been 13 years since his father died, and he says his family hasn't really been the same ever since. Among his five brothers, one separated himself for a bit.
He had to do his own healing and protect his own family and do what was right for him, and I totally respect that. There was brothers drifting further apart than other brothers, and yeah, it's definitely even in our own family, everyone's dealt with it quite differently.
And Carl Andreessen from the University of Melbourne says that is not an uncommon dynamic.
One of the reasons is that everyone experiences loss by suicide differently. And some people may have very strong grief reactions and have a strong need to talk about it. Other people may be more grieving on their own and have less need to talk about it. And when the grief is so strong and the other person is completely different, then you get a disconnection.
There's also the fact that different people in a family might have had a different quality of relationship with the person who's died. Some might have had a warmer, closer relationship. Others might have had distance and conflict.
And so, yes, it happens often that there are conflicts arising after loss by suicide because people do not understand each other anymore.
For Blake, the only way that he could move through his grief and process it was to eventually put it towards action. And the first thing he did was make some serious lifestyle changes.
I think it's the fact that before Dad took his own life, it masked my own problems. That stress I was feeling as a young dad with a mortgage, wanting to be the best husband I could be for my wife, who I absolutely adore. And I put so much pressure on myself to be that provider and be the happy surfer Blake, you know, that people felt good being around. Once I became self-aware enough, I realized that checking the bank accounts, you know, seven times a day and obsessively thinking about not being good enough, lying abed awake late at night and waking up in the morning and ruminating on things wasn't good mental health. You know, something that I do that I hold myself accountable to is starting my day with a routine that I've built up over the last decade. You know, I call it Earn the Sunrise. I get up early in the morning. I go for a barefoot run. About 7 kilometres, I come back, I do a back float in the ocean, I run up, kiss my wife goodbye, and then go and have coffee with the old surf lords, and it's 5:30 in the morning. So before the world even wakes up, I've done something physically challenged, I've connected with nature and community.
It's all the basics of good mental health, right?
And yeah, and the world hasn't even woken up yet. So when you don't need to have something as dramatic as a barefoot run and this, it's like do something intentionally for you. Get up, have a glass of water. Take your shoes off and go for a walk in the backyard, connecting with nature and that energy and that stillness. You know, do a round of breath work, all these things that are free and easy and accessible, but just done with intention, better than laying in bed, ruminating or pressing the snooze button as well.
The other thing that Blake has done to turn his grief into action is raise a bunch of money and break some records.
It was coming up for 10 years of my dad's passing, and I wanted to do something significant.
Yeah, it's awesome.
In 2023, he completed the world's longest surf session, clocking in more than 40 hours. And in the process, he raised around $500,000 for mental health charities.
The world's longest surf session.
I don't know how I got through. I was surfed 700 waves without the energy and support and the crowd feeling a part of something bigger than themselves. There's no way I could have ridden waves that exhausted.
And then last year, he broke the record for the world's largest paddle out.
I wanted to give back to the amazing community that got behind me, because traditionally paddle out ceremonies in surfing are to celebrate the lives of people who have passed. And this wasn't about celebrating someone who had passed. This was about celebrating one another and the positive impact that human connection and community has on our mental health. The headland was full, the beach was full, there was 1,027 surfers, some people that had never paddled a board, people with their insulin and medication in bum bags just wanting to be a part of it. And that last lap around on the jet ski, I felt like I could see teeth. Everyone was just grinning from ear to ear. Just so stoked they were a part of this thing. And all before we knew it, everyone was holding hands, 1,027 people, grown men, little kids, holding hands out in the ocean. It was just an incredible moment.
What Blake has experienced in the last few years with the changes he's made in his life and the fundraising that he's done is post-traumatic growth.
Post-traumatic growth is usually understood as a personal transformation, a psychological transformation that people go through as the result of the struggle with a traumatic event. And so the keywords are struggle.
Carl says the research indicates that those who develop personal growth or post-traumatic growth have often first struggled severely with their trauma.
Very often then accompanied by mental health struggles, intense grief, sometimes also suicidal behavior. But in the end, people find a way of coping, find a way of finding meaning, and a way of transforming their experiences into something positive.
How common is it for people to experience post-traumatic growth? And is there a certain kind of person that's most likely to experience it?
I'm not sure if you can say that there is a particular type of person. The research indicates that the struggle is a necessary condition. The research also indicates that being able to share experiences with others seems to facilitate post-traumatic growth because it also helps processing the grief in general, helps to find meaning and understanding in what people have been going through.
Mm.
So these factors seem to be important. But then how it exactly develops is also individually different. Some people may develop post-traumatic growth more into the finding value in social relationships. For other people, it may involve a change in career.
Carl says it's hard to say how common post-traumatic growth is, but research suggests somewhere between 20% and 50% of people will experience this. So that's hopeful. There is good that can come after trauma. But there's another point that's important to express as well.
It's also important, probably for listeners, that it's not because you do not develop post-traumatic growth that there is something wrong with your grief.
Mm.
Because some people may process their grief without a very strong struggle. For whatever reason, it may be a bit easier for them. And then they might not develop this post-traumatic growth. Doesn't mean that there is something wrong with them.
That's a really good point, because I have read briefly in places that this growing conversation around post-traumatic growth can leave some people feeling like they did their grief wrong, or they didn't achieve that, like unlock that next level.
You are correct that there is a lot of emphasis on this developing post-traumatic growth, but it's not essential. Let's put it that way. It's not essential for processing grief in a healthy way.
Alongside his own healing and processing, Blake has had to think about the needs of his own young family, in particular, his two young sons. Have you been able to talk to them about what happened with your father? Do you have any thoughts on how you will broach that one day?
Yeah, that was always a really tricky one. We always said that Poppy was sick, he wasn't well in his brain wasn't right. And it was a pretty emotional day when I told Bobby that his Poppy killed himself.
Oh, gosh.
It was a big moment for me.
Yeah.
I just, you know, didn't know what right way to do it or anything like that. And he kept asking one day. He was just being beautiful little Bobby, real curious. And it had been a few years since he'd been asking that question. And And yeah, I told him and I just broke down in tears because it just brought it all back up, you know.
Gosh, I cannot imagine how tricky that conversation would be when your son is asking what happened and you're deciding whether to tell the truth or not. I mean, how old was he?
Well, he was 10 at the time. Yeah. And look, I think that's something that needs to change. Suicide kills more people under the age of 45 than anything else. Yet the topic on it's taboo. If it was cancer he died from, he would have known when he was 5 years old.
Yeah.
So why is it so taboo and people feel shameful? That doesn't help the situation, you know?
That is exactly what Blake is trying to change by speaking so publicly about his experience. And when he thinks about his father's legacy, he doesn't think about money or material things. He thinks about his character.
He did what he said he was going to do. He was authentic and he had integrity. A legacy isn't defined by what house you left, what money you left for your kids and your family. It's by your actions. Like I can proudly say my four brothers were sadly not as close as we were, but I can say I'm so proud of the husbands that they are and the amazing dads they are, their work ethic, and that's the stuff that matters. That's a good life. That's a beautiful legacy to leave behind, and that's leaving the world in a better place.
That is Blake Johnston, surfer, mental health advocate, and author of the book Swell Being. Now, before we go, I did want to leave you with a few bits of practical advice on how you can maybe help someone in your life who might be grieving after a suicide. Here's clinical psychologist Tanya Hirvonen again.
What I wouldn't say is I know how you feel, or I've been in your shoes, or I understand what you're going through, because unless you're absolutely in that person's shoes, you wouldn't know. You would feel that empathy and that compassion, but to truly really know what that person's going through is the person themselves.
If you are a friend or a family member or a colleague, I don't think you have to take over the role of a counselor, for example, but just being there and allowing people to be themselves and give them time and space to grieve at their own pace is often helpful.
I guess the other thing is not promising, like if you're going to be there, make sure that you are going to be there. And rather than saying, I'm here if needed, making sure that you're working out what you can do, if you want to text, if you want to cook meals or drop things off for that person, but listening without feeling that you've got to problem solve or fix anything. If I was to put it in a nutshell, it's just providing non-judgmental supportive care.
Good advice. Big thanks to Tanya, as well as Carl Andreessen from the University of Melbourne for sharing their insights. That is it for All in the Mind this week. Thanks to producer Rose Kerr, senior producer James Bullen, and sound engineer Harvey O'Sullivan. I'm Sana Qadar. Thank you for listening. I'll catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.